ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, and we've all heard this tradition many times, mentioned in many different ways. In this tradition, the Imam says that one day the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, that is obviously on this day for some of us, which being the first of the holy month of Ramadan, the Holy Prophet said that, oh people, the month of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that is full of blessings and mercy and forgiveness has come to you. Now this is very beautiful, that the Holy Prophet doesn't say that you have entered it. He says, no, it has turned to you, it has come to you. It is a month that with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the best of months. Its days are the best of days. Its nights are the best of nights. Basically, every single thing in terms of the time that this month contains, that every moment of this month is the best of moments. And the Holy Prophet continues and says that its hours are the best of hours, its minutes are the best of minutes, and so on and so forth. Hence we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that if we started yesterday, or if we are starting today, that we are able to make use of every single moment that we are alive and we have the ability to do so in this blessed month of Ramadan, and to make a pact with ourselves that we do more, and not necessarily more in quantity but more in quality than we did in the previous years. Inshallah, I ask you to pray for us and for the Muslim Ummah. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh, here I am pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Just 2 days after the Israeli regime's sabotage of the Natanz nuclear facility, Iran announces the terrorist act has not been able to achieve its goal of hampering the country's internationally verified peaceful nuclear program. Iran will not only replace the damaged centrifuges with more advanced ones, it'll also put to operation 1,000 more advanced centrifuges soon. On top of that, Iran will raise uranium enrichment level from 20% to 60% as of tomorrow. And all this while, Tehran is engaged in talks with the P4 plus one of Vienna regarding the lifting of U.S.-imposed sanctions aimed at reviving the nuclear deal. Stay with us for a debate on different aspects of this issue.
Iran has officially informed the International Atomic Energy Agency of its plan to start enriching uranium to a 60% purity level as of Wednesday, following Sunday's act of sabotage against the country's Natanz nuclear facility that Tehran blamed on Israel.
Yesterday, we send a letter to the agency that we are going to add 1,000 more centrifuges to Natanz facility. That is in addition to the current number of machines. Also today, we just send a new letter to the agency saying that we would start from tomorrow enrichment up to 60%.
Araghchi said the terror act against the Natanz site will help boost Iran's enrichment capacities. He also touched upon Iran's demands that it would put forward during the upcoming talks with the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA in Vienna.
We insist on what we have asked that all sanctions should be lifted, we verify, and then we go back to full compliance if we are satisfied with the verification process.
President Hassan Rouhani also said all parties to the 2015 pact must honor the commitments they made while inking the accord. The Vienna talks that will be held this week have been eclipsed by the sabotage incident at Iran's Natanz uranium enrichment facility. In a letter to the UN chief, Iran's foreign minister blamed Israel for the incident, saying the move amounts to a war crime and nuclear terrorism. Mohammad Javad Zarif also denounced what he called Israel's terrorist idiocy, saying the regime has made a very bad gamble by sabotaging the Natanz facility that would strengthen Iran's hand in talks to salvage the JCPOA. He also warned the U.S. that neither sanctions nor acts of sabotage can serve as leverage in JCPOA talks.
Americans should know that neither sanctions nor acts of sabotage will give them leverage in the negotiations, and that such measures will only make things harder for them.
Israeli media have acknowledged that Israel was behind the incident at the Iranian nuclear facility, but the U.S., Israel's closest ally, has denied any involvement. Nonetheless, on the same day that the Natanz site was targeted, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was meeting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who vowed again to do everything in his power to stop a verse for salvaging the JCPOA. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden says it wants to revive the Iran nuclear deal, but for now, the sabotage act at the Natanz facility has further deepened Tehran's distrust towards Washington.
Okay, now let's start this debate here. Joining me tonight will be security analyst Mahan Abedin in our Tehran studios. We'll also have journalist and commentator Julia Qasem joining us out of Beirut. Good to have both of you in the show. Now let's go to Mahan first. Mahan, this is not the first time that the Tel Aviv regime is trying to throw a wrench into Iran's peaceful nuclear program. But the irony is that the hostile action prompted Iran to further its nuclear activity. As of tomorrow, as you know, Iran will start uranium enrichment at 60%. The country will also put to operation 1,000 advanced centrifuges. It looks like that the Israeli scheme has failed again, don't you agree?
Well, you know, Israel and other hostile states have been trying to sabotage Iran's civilian nuclear program and other critical national infrastructure for more than 15 years now. And these sabotage operations have taken different forms, cyber attacks, terrorism, bomb attacks, the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. And with all these attacks, undoubtedly, they gain some operational or technical advantage. But these attacks have never, ever, up to now, managed to change the big strategic picture. They do not change Iran's calculus and Iran's determination to go ahead with its development plans. Now, today's announcement was a very good example. These hostile states, we assume it's Israel, it hasn't been confirmed yet, took action against a critical national infrastructure, and Iran's response is to speed up nuclear enrichment from 20% to 60%, bring into line new state-of-the-art centrifuges, a new generation of centrifuges. And bear in mind, much of the centrifuges that have been damaged in previous attacks, they belong to a previous generation of centrifuges. So they were, by today's standards, pretty useless anyway. So in direct answer to your question, a hostile state will undertake these actions with a view to gaining some kind of a tactical advantage. But the bottom line is they do not shift the strategic picture. They do not have the desired outcome for the perpetrators. And that's the important point.
Okay. Now, let me turn to Beirut. Julia, U.S. Defense Secretary was meeting with Israeli officials at the time of the Natanz sabotage. He spoke of everything except this country's opposition, to Tel Aviv's sabotage of the Iranian Natanz facility. Why should Washington engage in talks to revive the nuclear deal, as it is claiming, at the same time, allow Tel Aviv to target Iran's nuclear facility?
Yeah, as was just said, that the cyber attacks against the centrifuges, it has been a tactic in the works for over 15 years now. The first time that it was implemented was through actually a Dutch mole in collusion with both the CIA and Mossad. So time and time again, these cyber attacks have been an act of collusion between the United States and Israel, which kind of do not act independent of each other, or rogue, I believe. So it's pretty understandable that there is a collusion going on in their aims of sabotage of Iran's nuclear program. Right now, the Biden administration is kind of operating under the facade of wanting to do negotiations, but on the U.S.'s terms, which is why essentially the talks failed, as the deal failed as well. And with Israel, it's just more of a rogue strategy of kind of achieving the same objectives of sabotaging Iran's nuclear enrichment development. But of course, as we know, Israel is very short-sighted in that regard. Those centrifuges, as was mentioned, were old anyway. They were due to be replaced. So Iran's response in resistance to Israel's attack, but also in full assumption of its own right to develop energy, sovereign energy, has chosen to increase the enrichment to 60% as of tomorrow. So I believe that based off the historical precedent of these cyber attacks, as well as the coinciding goals that both the U.S. and Israel have against Iran, ultimately, that they couldn't have been acting in the course.
Okay, now, Mahan, in the same lines, I want to put this question to you. Could Tel Aviv have taken this hostile action it took against Iran without informing Washington and getting its green light?
Well, the short answer is no, and I tend to concur to some extent with your guest in Beirut. These actions, these sabotage actions or cyber attacks or other forms of hostile activity, they tend to be collaborative. So it's a case of collusion between several hostile states. Very rarely do they happen independently. Now, we know with the biggest attack to date, there's the so-called Stuxnet attack back in 2010. This was a collaborative effort between the Americans and the Israelis. Now, we don't have sufficient information to determine the extent of collusion in the latest attacks. But the bottom line is that the Israeli entity, you know, it doesn't have the strategic capacity or even wherewithal to act independently. This is this is an established fact, I think, and most experts would concur with that. So, and of course, this creates all sorts of questions, because some of these hostile states, whilst they're trying to actively sabotage Iran's nuclear program, they're also at the same time pretending to be engaged in dialogue and diplomacy. So that really calls into question their motivation and their sincerity. And I think this is something which the Iranian diplomatic establishment has to contend with. Just how serious are their diplomatic interlocutors sitting at the other side of the table? Yes.
And of course, Iran has not waited for that, Mahan. Iran is doing its job no matter what comes out of those negotiations.
Well,
now,
just to finish my point, absolutely.
Sure.
So, there's several dimensions here. There's the security dimension, the strategic dimension, and the diplomatic track.
Mm-hmm.
As I explained with the actual nature of these attacks, the damage that they inflict on Iranian infrastructure is at best tactical. They don't change the big strategic picture. And most important of all, they do not alter Iran's strategic calculus. And today's announcement is a testament to that.
Mm-hmm.
Iran has announced that it's going to actually intensify its activities in the nuclear sphere in response to this particular sabotage operation.
Right. Julia, Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif has asserted that neither sanctions nor sabotage can serve as a lever for Washington in the nuclear-related negotiations going on, as you know, if that's what they are pursuing. Let's have your thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, actually both of those things have been factors to actually motivate Iran to pursue its sovereign strategies of nuclear enrichment, economic development, nuclear development. But kind of goes to show it's a miscalculation on the U.S. end. And it's why it almost seems like the strategy of, you know, getting Iran to negotiate on the West terms seems like a little bit more of kind of like a diplomatic way of actually sabotaging it and slowing down its nuclear development. as we can remember a couple days ago, it officially looked like the talks were failing, even though the premise of them, where Washington didn't want to remove the sanctions, poised it to fail from the get-go. But as we kind of saw the confirmation of Washington, you know, not wanting to remove the sanctions, not wanting to live up to its commitments, really, I believe that Israel kind of like launched this last-ditch effort to try to sabotage the centrifuges. But of course, just like the sanctions, that only encourages Iran to further move on its plans to develop its enrichment, you know, enrich its uranium and kind of produce a more sovereign strategy of economic development, given that, you know, the parties on the other side of the table directly or in collusion with these sabotagers to begin with.
Let me ask Mahan this question, that Tehran has strongly criticized, Mahan, what it calls Tel Aviv's nuclear terrorism, because it wouldn't only impact Iran, it could have led to a large-scale environmental issue endangering other parts of the world, too. So the end justifies the means. That's the Israeli approach, right?
Well, this is a really good question, and it speaks to the recklessness of these attacks. The attacks we've seen over the past 15 years have been really dangerous because they are targeted at critical infrastructure. In this instance, a nuclear facility. We know that nuclear facilities the world over are vulnerable assets. We saw the Fukushima thing back in Japan in 2011, other instances when nuclear infrastructure, civilian ones for that matter, somehow become vulnerable, and that just poses huge environmental challenges and huge pressures. Now, in this instance, thankfully, there hasn't been an environmental impact, but the fact remains that attacks of this kind, with callous disregard for the immediate environment, indeed the broader environment, and as you just stated, potentially the global environment, it speaks to the recklessness of these actors. So if the question is, does the end justify the means? Certainly from their point of view, it does. And this just goes to show how important it is for them to halt Iran's progress in the scientific sphere. You know, they are absolutely obsessed by this because they've been taken aback by Iran's strategic momentum in other areas, in the regional domain, that Iran and its allies are victorious. They have the strategic advantage. They have seen how the Trump administration's maximum pressure policy, which amounted to of an attempt to economically paralyze Iran, they saw that has not worked. The Iranian economy has proven to be much more resilient than they ever anticipated. So they have seen these gains on Iran's part. They have seen that they cannot get the strategic advantage in a conventional sense. So they resort to these attacks with a view to arresting Iran's strategic momentum, with callous disregard for anything else, be it civilians, you know, civilian casualties and damage to the environment.
Julia, Iran has stated clearly that it does reserve the right to revenge in due time, and some analysts criticize it for not giving a strong response to the Israeli move, and there are some others who are praising this as self-restraint that's being practiced by Iran, which they argue that nullifies Tel Aviv's intention to instigate Tehran to kind of rush to take some hasty and harsh action in response. In what context do you assess Iran's stance?
Yeah, so I would say that it's not, you know, restraint in the sense that it just kind of wants to be the peace broker just for the kind of, for a pacifistic sense, for a pacifist sense. But at the same time, I wouldn't say that there's really anything to criticize because, I mean, one, what do most of us know about the strategic analysis that Iran is really taking with regards to its response? But also, Iran's not going to respond on Israel's timetable because Israel's going to want to take harsh action based on what it believes is going to be advantageous to it and enable it to kind of wage further strikes against Iran in just a very restless way, of course. Of course, Netanyahu wants war. Of course, the Zionist entity wants war. And they want it in a way that gives them the second strike advantage and that could be predictable in their regard. So, of course, Iran is going to respond. But it's going to respond strategically. It's going to respond with full intentionality and with full respect to its strategy, its own strategy, not Israel's. So I think this actually is what really terrifies Israel, that it is able to have a lot of restraint in the short run, in order to achieve its goals in the long run. And Israel knows it can't, it can't really be successful in any military confrontation ultimately against Iran. So it just tries to also sabotage them militarily by inciting some kind of short-term, small-scale retaliation that Iran did this.
Now, Mahan, as you know, negotiations are underway in Vienna, and Arafat is there, and they are starting it tomorrow officially. Not much was achieved in the first round of the Vienna talks last Friday, though. So, what do you expect could come out of the second round that's starting tomorrow? Will go on for a couple of days. Tehran has asserted, of course, as you know, that it wants all the U.S. sanctions. And all the U.S. sanctions means those imposed during the Obama term, during the Trump term, to be removed at one go.
Well, as far as diplomacy in Vienna is concerned, Iran's position really hasn't changed. Iran's position was set out some time ago by the leadership and then further down by the institutions that are tasked with foreign policy. So Iran's position is if Iran is going to scale back its actions over the past 18 months to go back into full compliance with the JCPOA, then sanctions not only have to be fully lifted, in fact they have to be verifiably lifted, and that takes time. So it's no good for the Americans to say, oh, we're going to lift sanctions, can you go back into your commitments now? Absolutely not. These have to be verified. For instance, Iran will have to be able to sell its oil in the international markets without any obstacles or hindrance, and other sanctions,
and also get access to the money.
Yeah, and other sanctions, I was about to say that, other sanctions targeting the financial sector, Iran's blocked assets around the world, they have to be unfrozen, and Iran needs immediate and full access to that. So these have to be verified. So the position in that regard hasn't changed. But look, just take a look at the discussion we've had this evening. Now, if this proves to be a synchronized attack by, say, two hostile states, I'm not going to name them because we don't have that information. So this is purely speculative. So if one party, for instance, hopes to gain some kind of leverage over this attack, they would argue that Iran's leverage has been removed as a result of this attack, so it's easier to negotiate with them, then the Iranian negotiators are going to prove them very wrong, because that bottom line is not going to change. It didn't change with the first round of the Vienna negotiations, and I suspect it will not change with the second one. And let's take stock of the broader strategic picture. The former U.S. administration imposed what they called maximum pressure policy in Iran, which amounted to a kind of economic blockade. That was an abysmal failure. The current administration in the U.S. concedes it was a failure, and yet it doesn't have the moral courage or the political conviction to actually reverse that policy. So until they reverse that mindset and reverse that policy, there's not going to be progress on the diplomatic aspect.
Okay, that's all the time we have had for this debate show. Let me thank my guests. We had security analyst Mahan Abedin in Tehran and journalist and commentator Julia Qasem, who joined us in Beirut and Lebanon with their comments and insight. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program.
Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show.
today's lesson, The Effects of Fasting and Hunger. It has been narrated from the commander of the faithful Imam Ali alayhi salam. Don't say Ramadan because you don't know what Ramadan is. Instead of saying Ramadan, say the way Allah has called it, the month of Ramadan. The most important duty of a devoted wayfarer in this month, in this great month rather, is to understand the right of this holy month in which Allah has invited the wayfarer of his path for a feast. Also, he must understand the correct meanings of fasting and its relevance with Allah's invitation. Having discovered this reality, he must endeavor that all his actions and deeds are accompanied with required devotion and sincerity in order to earn the pleasure of his host Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this is how the Ramadan, the holy month of Ramadan, needs to be looked at.
Ramadan al-mustabin Jaa bin nur al-mubin Marhaban bil-ta'ibin Marhaban bil-abidin في صلاة الخاشعين في رحاب الذاكرين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the effects of fasting and hunger. Tolerance of hunger, the most obvious part of fasting, earns plenty of advantages for a devoted wayfarer journeying towards Allah's path from the point of view of enlightenment and knowledge of Allah. In addition to this, his advancement in attaining spiritual perfection becomes possible in this very month. This has been emphasized in plenty of narrations from Prophet and Ahlul Bayt. Engaging yourself in self-struggle, which is also known as jihad an-nafs, through the means of hunger and thirst, whose reward is equivalent to the rewards of those who participated in the armed struggle for Allah's sake. There is nothing more superior before Allah's sight than tolerating hunger and thirst during fasting. This is how the outlook on the holy month of Ramadan is. This is that great and blessed month where the doors of mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala open up for his servants, those servants who are serious to attain that spiritual elevation. Allah makes it easier for them to get to that desired level. So brothers and sisters, we have to make sure that we understand and realize the effects of fasting and hunger in the holy month of Ramadan. Surely it is something that we all can benefit from.
Forgive me for everything I've done in the past, when everything was going so fast, and now I just can't go on. Forgive me for everything I've done in the light, for everything I've done in the night that I thought wasn't wrong. But I know that you are really loving, you are really caring.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allah, you forgive me for everything that's that's wrong in my life, and everything that wasn't right. Going through life like a fool. Forgive me before the day comes when I die. I open up my eyes, now I'm trying to fight. Cause I've walked away. Came back for you. Don't take me away.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Around the world with reporters.
Restaurateurs, gym owners, and business people from various other industries have continued to stage protests across Italy, demanding the government to immediately lift the ban on their activities. A protest dubbed Io Apro, I Open, was staged in central Rome. Hundreds of angry business people tried to head towards the parliament building but were met by police in riot gear and had to detour to nearby San Silvestro Square. Here they shouted, "Freedom and let us get back to work," with some hurling smoke flares and other objects.
Under Italy's current red and orange zone restrictions, restaurants remain closed at night and are open for takeaway only during the day, whereas swimming pools and fitness centers are closed all day.
We are exasperated by the situation and by the way the police treat us. This is just repression. They do not even allow us to demonstrate. The government must let us return to our work. We have lost 60-70% of our earnings. The protest turned nasty when protesters, infiltrated by alt-right activists and professional organizers of social unrest, threw firecrackers and objects at police. Officers charged the protesters after they tried to breach a police cordon.
The government keeps ignoring us. My shop has been closed since October, but the rent and all bills must be paid anyway. How can we continue this way? I am afraid some people will resort to extreme acts.
Meanwhile, restrictions were eased across most of Italy after six regions were downgraded from red to orange on Monday. However, Prime Minister Mario Draghi has said Italy will have no moderate risk yellow zones this month in an attempt to keep the spread of the virus down while his government tries to step up a much-delayed vaccination campaign. Max Civili, Rome. ¶¶
increasing the number of...
Boris Johnson is the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. That is a fact. But according to a senior former British civil servant, Philip Rycroft, the COVID-19 pandemic has seeded the idea of a Prime Minister who speaks for England alone. In a study looking at the issues of devolution from inside the UK state machinery, the former permanent secretary to the Brexit department stated that the 300-year-old union is in deep peril due to no defined strategy by Westminster.
In the context of COVID, where each of the constituent nations' devolved governments are essentially self-governing, this has inculcated a sense that Britain is not a unified nation, UK is not unified, and it's never been more divided and never been more angry. And to all intents, I think it's fair to say that Boris Johnson, at least unofficially, is the Prime Minister of England only. He doesn't seem to care about the union.
The crisis has been exacerbated amid growing momentum for a second referendum on Scottish independence, with a recent poll showing that pro-independence parties would win 79 of 129 seats in Holyrood in the upcoming elections. Moreover, there's also a growing independence movement in Wales that will add to Westminster's woes. Meanwhile, in Northern Ireland, there's been a serious deterioration of relations between the nationalist and loyalist communities following the implementation of the Brexit deal, which has resulted in some of the worst street violence to have taken place in recent years.
I think Northern Ireland has been used as a pawn. It's been used as a pawn by the British government. It's been used as a pawn by the European Union.
The report, co-authored by Professor Michael Kenny, claimed it was political decision-making made by Westminster mixed with a lack of consultation with dissolved governments and confused messaging that has caused widening divisions, with Rycroft claiming that Boris Johnson's muscular brand of unionism had asserted the value of the union rather than demonstrating it.
Boris Johnson and his crew of hard right ideologues have substituted flag-waving British nationalism for clear-headed policy designed to make people in different parts of the UK feel they're part of something united rather than increasingly polarised. And when the flag waving starts, the thinking stops. And when the thinking stops, the road to ruin is set. And this UK is on a road to ruin.
The warnings laid out in this new report are stark. Unless there's a change in strategy from Downing Street, then the future of the United Kingdom as four nations, England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, is in doubt. Ahmed Kabbalah, London.
This is the first time in over four decades that a South Korean Prime Minister visits Iran. Chung Sik-yoon arrived in Tehran on Sunday for a three-day visit that aims to boost bilateral ties. During his trip, Chung held talks with high-ranking Iranian officials, including Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf and Ali Larijani, who was an advisor to leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Chung's historic visit is viewed as an icebreaker to forge stronger ties between Seoul and Tehran after years of strained relations. Now to start with, Tehran says Seoul should unlock billions of dollars of Iranian assets frozen in its banks. The figure is roughly $8.5 billion of Iranian revenues made from oil sales to Seoul. The funds are now blocked in two South Korean banks for fears of running afoul of U.S. sanctions against the Islamic Republic. Tehran says South Korea's inaction toward the issue has been the main barrier in the way of further development of bilateral relations.
Unfortunately, relations between Tehran and Seoul have not seen any development in the past 3 years due to South Korea's adherence to U.S. anti-Iran sanctions that lack any international legitimacy.
The South Korean premier said his country is determined to solve the issue and will make its utmost efforts to prepare the ground for Iran's access to its assets.
South Korea will increase its cooperation with the related countries to unfreeze the Iranian financial resources. This is to get both sides out of the current deadlock in bilateral relations.
Before the U.S. intensified its sanctions on Iran, South Korea was one of the country's largest trade partners outside West Asia and its fourth largest oil customer. Following the 2015 nuclear deal, bilateral trade reached $12 billion in 2017. Yet these exports tumbled down after the U.S. reinstated anti-Iran sanctions in 2018, dropping to minus $90 million in the first half of 2020.
South Korea used to be one of the major clients of Iran oil, and Iran was also a permanent market for membership was abrupted, we halted by United States sanctions. And I think the two sides have made up their mind to resume their friendly ties despite the United States' will.
Shunk's visit follows the Islamic Republic's release of a South Korean oil tanker about 3 months after its seizure over alleged oil pollution. The move is interpreted by observers as an act of rapprochement that, if Seoul compensates by releasing the Iranian assets, can open a new chapter in the two countries' political and trade ties. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Israel has made no secret of its hostility toward Iran since the Islamic Revolution of 1979, which led to the ouster of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi monarchy. Israel, which is also a fierce opponent of Iran's peaceful nuclear program, has been behind the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists over the past years. On Sunday, Iran's Natanz nuclear facility in the central province of Isfahan was hit by a power outage. Israeli media confirmed that the Mossad spy agency carried out a cyber attack on the site. Iran also blamed the Israeli regime for the incident.
What happened in Natanz was a bold act of nuclear terrorism on Iranian soil. It can be considered under the category of crimes against humanity, which the Israeli regime has been doing that for many years now.
Said Khatibzadeh stressed that the incident will not slow down the country's nuclear program, rather it will speed up its advancement. He said the IR-1 centrifuges damaged in the blackout will be replaced with more advanced ones. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif also accused Israel of sabotaging the Natanz facility and pledged revenge against Tel Aviv for the attack. Zarif suggested that the attack was an attempt to derail the talks held in the Austrian capital with the aim of reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. The European Union also said the incident in Natanz could have been an act of sabotage and warned against any attempts to derail the JCPOA talks, which will resume on Wednesday in Vienna between Tehran and the remaining signatories to the deal.
And the bottom line for us is that we are saying that we are rejecting any attempts to undermine or to derail the ongoing diplomatic activities to try to resolve all the open questions regarding Iranian nuclear deal. We try to resolve them through diplomatic means currently in Vienna in the ongoing process of talks and negotiations of the parties of the JCPOA and through our contacts with the United States.
Russia also expressed hope that the attack on the Iranian nuclear facility will not undermine the Vienna negotiations. The Sunday attack came as U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was in Israel for talks with Benjamin Netanyahu, who vowed to do everything in his power to stop efforts for salvaging the JCPOA. U.S. media say Washington, which is Israel's closest ally, was not involved in the attack on the Natanz facility, but the timing of Austin's trip has raised doubts about the claim. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has stressed that Tehran cannot trust promises made by the new U.S. administration regarding the revival of the JCPOA. Now the attack on the Natanz nuclear facility can deepen the distrust as the incident further questions the sincerity of such promises.
The Islamic Jihad movement and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine held a sit-in in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. The event took place near the Israeli-controlled Erez crossing in northern Gaza. The move comes as thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to suffer from inhumane treatment and are being denied their basic rights. The Israeli regime has imprisoned nearly 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Many Palestinian prisoners suffer from chronic illnesses and are denied proper medical treatment by Israel's prison service, who runs Israeli prisons.
The Islamic Jihad and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine came together today to express solidarity with the prisoners who are languishing in Israeli jails. The conditions of prisoners are only getting worse as days go by under the watchful eye of the international community.
Palestinian prisoners are subjected to degrading conditions, including administrative detention, solitary confinement, and bans on family visits. Palestinians say that Arab countries normalizing relations with the Israeli regime are encouraging Tel Aviv to violate the rights of Palestinians.
The normalization by Arab regimes has badly affected the conditions of Palestinian prisoners. Normalization of ties with the Zionists is a betrayal of Palestine and the Palestinian prisoners. All Arabs must understand that the United States and Israel are the enemies of the Arab and Muslim nations.
Securing the release of prisoners is a highly emotive issue for Palestinians who regard them as prisoners of war and the symbols of resistance against Israeli occupation. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, PFLP, vowed to use all forms of resistance to free Palestinian prisoners.
The so-called peace deals will not free Palestinian prisoners. Only resistance can free Palestinian prisoners from Zionist jails. Capturing more Israeli soldiers to exchange them with Palestinian prisoners must be a top priority for all Palestinian resistance groups.
Statistics show that over 200 Palestinian detainees have died in Israeli prisons since 1967 due to medical negligence. According to prisoners' advocacy groups, Israel is currently holding some 5,000 Palestinians behind bars, including women and children. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
The Yemeni army says two of its drones hit Jazan Airport and King Khalid Air Base, both in southwestern Saudi Arabia. The army says this is part of intensified attacks to retaliate Riyadh's ongoing war on Yemen.
We are entitled to carry out the attacks as part of our normal and legitimate right to respond to the escalation of Saudi Arabia and its comprehensive blockade on our country, and we promise the Saudi regime more painful operations as long as the aggression and siege continues.
His comments come as over the past months, Saudi Arabia has either roundly denied any Yemeni attacks inside the country or claimed Yemeni missiles and drones were intercepted before making impact.
The Saudi regime realizes that it may lose face if people of the country come to know about the Yemeni attacks. The Saudi regime is controlling its people by force, and it is afraid of an internal revolution against the ruling regime. So, this is why Riyadh continues to avoid talking about the Yemeni attacks.
Military experts say the Yemeni army is well capable of expanding its attacks to a wider range of targets to make them more painful for Riyadh. They say this could inflict greater damage to Saudi Arabia economically and militarily.
Saudi Arabia must realize that the painful phase is yet to come. Saudi Arabia will lose its economic power and military capabilities in this phase. Saudi Arabia says its army is the sixth most powerful army in the world, but 6 years of war on Yemen have proven that the Saudi army is extremely weak and has achieved nothing, while the Yemeni military capabilities have increased. And I believe that the continuation of this war is further damaging to the kingdom.
Yemeni army's escalation of retaliatory attacks is a response to the deadly Saudi-led aggression and siege that caused the deaths of tens of thousands of people, many of them women and the children.
Saudi Arabia has been calling for peace talks with Yemeni forces to stop their attacks while refusing to grant their demand to end its years-long war and siege on Yemen. This leaves the Yemeni army no option but to step up its retaliatory attacks against the kingdom. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky held talks with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Istanbul. The visit comes amid tensions between Kiev and Moscow over Ukraine's eastern Donbas region. Meanwhile, Russia bulked up its military presence on Ukraine's eastern border, threatening military action. During the meeting, the two presidents spoke about ways of cooperation in different sectors and strengthening ties between the two countries, including free trade, tourism, and sports. Following the meeting, which was also attended by ministers from both sides, a number of agreements were signed.
Turkey strongly defends the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine. We hope that the escalation in eastern Ukraine will come to an end and the conflict will be resolved through dialogue based on the Minsk agreement.
The United States, after informing Turkey as per the Montreux Convention, sent two warships through Turkish straits towards the Black Sea. Turkish Foreign Ministry said the warships will stay in the Black Sea until May 4.
The tension between Russia and Ukraine is increasing every minute. Ukraine is waiting for support from the EU and the US. But Russia has clearly expressed that Crimea is its red line and will not give it to Ukraine. I think this visit is aimed at sorting things out. Ukraine wants to make sure that Turkey is on its side, especially after the phone call between Turkish and Russian presidents.
Late on Friday, Russian President Vladimir Putin discussed with his Turkish counterpart over the phone the Ukraine crisis and the presence of U.S. warships in the Black Sea. Turkish president assured that Ankara's cooperation with Ukraine does not mean it is against Russia. Analysts believe Turkey is trying to play the role of peacemaker in the region without taking sides. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
It was an utter shock for the destitute Rohingya community in India after the country's Supreme Court rejected the petition seeking halt on the deportation process. The court in its ruling said the deportation process could go ahead as long as the government follows due process. Now more panic has gripped the community as their last hope seems lost. Experts say the Supreme Court ruling will give a sense of relief to the community for a while from being deported instantly. They, however, believe the ruling doesn't stop the detention process. Rather, it gives government more freedom to act swiftly. Legal experts are shocked about the judgment, saying the country has welcomed refugees from several countries since decades, but adopted a hostile approach towards Rohingya in particular. India has no legislation on the refugees, and it considers Rohingya as illegal immigrants and a threat to national security.
They can be deported in accordance with the law. Now, which law? Law, according to the government, means the Foreigners Act. Now, Foreigners Act doesn't deal with refugees. Refugees are a different category of people. We had argued that even non-citizens, even refugees, have Article 21 rights, the right to life.
In recent weeks, dozens or more refugees were detained from New Delhi. The police maintains they have orders from higher authorities to carry detention process. Now grief has befallen the destitute community. Rights activists say treating these refugees differently is a blow on India's ethos of Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which means the world is one family.
Why is it not our concern if there are refugees coming from there? It's not just the refugee law. There are so many laws dealing with the rights of children, the Human Rights Convention, the Civil and Political Rights Convention. They all talk about the principle of non-refoulement, which means that you cannot send somebody to a country or outside your territory where there will be danger to his life or limb.
Anti-Rohingya sentiments have risen since the emergence of Hindu nationalist government of BJP in 2014. Since then, many anti-Rohingya campaigns and Hindu groups have been demanding their expulsion. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
IRIB English Radio presents The Month of Allah. Let's be with Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Abbas Razavian.
As I look to nature's beauty, dazzled am I, knowing everything calls on you, the Lord Most High.
Allahumma. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalam ala ashrafil anbiya'i wal mursaleen. Sayyidina Abul Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad wa Ahl Baytihi at-Tayyibin at-Tahirin. I welcome you to the program Month of Allah, It is the month of Ramadan. It is a special time for the believers. And it is a time that we need to focus on ourselves and our connection with God. During such a time, I ask you, brothers and sisters, what kind of feeling do you have? And I ask you, what kind of feeling should you have? I understand that when we look at the traditions from the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt, that there are many traditions that bring about excitement and joy in this month. And one of these sets of groups is from the tradition that I'll read for you, is that if we understood how the month of Ramadan, how blessed it was, if we understood its true significance, لَوَدَّ أَن يَكُونَ رَمَضَانُ السَّنَةِ, you wish that the holy month of Ramadan would equal one entire year. So this set of traditions show us excitement, show us joy, show us that we are becoming a guest of Allah. In another tradition, as we have in the famous sermon of the Prophet of Islam in the month of Shaban, before the month of Ramadan approached us, the Prophet of Islam says, he says that this is Shahrullah, it is the month of Allah. This is a great feeling that we should have as believers, that we are entering the time zone and the time period that is attributed to God. So this is one set of emotions that we have. But when we look at other narrations, there are also other emotions that we should be having about this month of Ramadan. Not only should it be excitement and joy and anticipation, but also on the other side, we see narrations. For example, in the dua from Imam Sajjad alayhi salam in Sahifa Sajjadiyah, there are two sets of supplications that he has. One is number 44 and one is number 45. 45 supplication, the 44 is about the entrance in the month of Ramadan. The 45th is about the farewell to the month of Ramadan. In supplication 44, we read something very interesting. And that is, he says in his supplications, وَأَلْهِمْنَا مَعْرِفَةَ فَضْلِهِ وَأَجْلَالَ حُرْمَتِهِ, give me the knowledge of the excellence of this month, how much virtue it has, and also veneration of its sacredness. This is also a sacred month. Not only should we be experiencing joy, happiness, but also we should be experiencing caution. How are we experiencing caution? Because this is a sacred month. This is a month that has haybat. This is a month that is revered in the eyes of the believers. So I ask you, brothers and sisters, what should we be cautious of? What should we be worried about? And the answer to this is, because the month of Ramadan is so revered, is so great, we are afraid that, God forbid, maybe our actions will not be accepted this month. Maybe our fast will not be accepted. Maybe our prayers will not be heard because of maybe some sins that we might take. Or maybe, for example, the spirituality that we should be having this month, it should be at a very high level, and that we don't have the tawfiq of reaching those high levels. So we are also worried because our destiny is going to be determined in this month. So there are two emotions in this month: the emotion of happiness, excitement, and joy, and also of veneration and caution. And this, in another words, can be termed as al-khawf and al-raja, meaning we have fear that we are going to perform well, and also we have hope in Allah's mercy, and also in Allah being a host, and we are His guests. And a true believer puts khawf and raja in between, and at the same time, he has veneration towards the month of Ramadan and its prohibitions, and is afraid of breaking the rules that God has made, and also has hope in attaining Allah's pleasure in this month. Wa sallallahu ala Sayyidina Muhammadin wa ahla bayti tayyibin tahirin. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
قال الإمام الصادق عليه السلام: يسأل الميت في قبره عن خمس: عن صلاته وزكاته وحجه وصيامه وولايته إيانا أهل البيت، فتقول الولاية من جانب القبر للأربع ما دخل في كل